Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. Today we're going to resume Volume 3 of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. The Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, Sick Jew. Put together by the researchers of the Nation of Islam operating out of Chicago. And we're going to do 276 through, 304. And conclude the Leo Frank's fight for redemption. So this would be about the third or fourth session within this chapter. This will be slightly shorter than the others, but still a good hour, let's say. Maybe a little more. But anyway, you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Also later, eventually, permanently archived when it's complete at alexlinder.com. So, on page 276, Leo Frank's pardon and crucifixion. Pardon in quotes. Two epigraphs. Now, here's that dirty little Jew. I don't know who is guilty. But I do know that the man who murdered Mary Fagan ought to be hanged. Leo Max Frank said that. I don't know who is guilty, lied the Jew. And again, from Steve Oney, one of the book writers about this case and affair. Finally, though, the men who threw themselves into the scheme were motivated by neither bloodlust nor anti-Semitism. Rather, they felt obliged, to accept an urgent and weighty responsibility. Steve Oney, and I'm a Jew, and I assume he's talking about the ones who lynched, as the Jews like to say, Leo Frank, or as Tom Watson, the defender of Georgia, defamed by the Jewish media, an irregular execution. Again, page 276. For 16 months after Leo Frank's August 25th, 1930 murder conviction, his legal team trekked from court to court seeking to win him a new trial. They were buoyed by a growing international outcry, impressively engineered by Albert Lasker, again the father of modern advertising, a Jew out of the Midwest, that included a massive blitzkrieg of propaganda and letter writing and petition campaigns. But by December of 1914, Frank's appeals had failed in every venue, rejected time after time by judges who found his trial to be fair and the verdict to be properly rendered. That's when the United States Supreme Court agreed to consider the case, and there can be no doubt that the inside connections that Frank's attorney Lewis Marshall had with the High Court helped secure that hearing. Again, Lewis Marshall, kind of the number one Jew in America, a very powerful leader of the Jews in New York, and their main base of operations. All the Jews flooding in 1880 to 1920 are coming into New York, and they have their Kahila, kind of their government of Jews in exile, and he's number one among them, the most powerful Jew in America, most likely. And then out of the Midwest is Albert Lasker, running all kinds of national ad campaigns, pushing, you know, for the first time, national products, as we have national electronic networks starting to develop, as the states are kind of filling in with people and with new technology for communication and transportation. So Jews are using and enjoying these tools of enhanced leverage that come about in the 20th century, and some in the late 19th century. Lewis Marshall, prepared Frank's legal brief, which claimed that 103 errors in Judge Roan's Atlanta courtroom obligated the High Court to grant Leo Frank a new trial. Marshall focused in on highly technical points of law and procedure that mirrored, in its exasperating technicality, Leo Frank's disastrous courtroom statement, when he went on and on about the minutiae of running a pencil company instead of addressing the charges facing him. Frank's tedious and grating rehearsal of the factory's administrative minutiae to a jury expecting to hear of his actions on the day of the murder most assuredly contributed to an adverse verdict. And even with many months of hindsight, Marshall's brief was hundreds of pages of the same trifling details and seemed targeted more toward delay than resolution. proof of its utter ineffectiveness in defending Leo Frank is how little of Marshall's brief is quoted by Frank's advocates in the many books and articles constituting the Leo Frank case literature of the last century. Remarkably, not a single one of the 103 complaints addressed any of the obvious racial injustices of the Georgia court system. Marshall, who in later years would help fashion the NAACP's legal strategy, did not complain of an all-white jury, or an all-Gentile jury, for that matter, or of a Jim Crow legal system that was so patently racist that it almost perfectly prefigured the legal structure of the coming Nazi regime. None of those issues bothered the Frank legal team, even when they had the opportunity to raise them in front of the nation's highest court in Washington, D.C., far away from any Southern influence. Though the Negro testimony theme continued or constituted the core of Leo Frank's public relations strategy, that this was a, you know, black's crime, not a white man's crime, relying on a generality instead of acknowledging that maybe this case was the exception. That might be generally true, but in this case, the facts, the evidence, the testimony shows that the Jew did it. Though the quote, Negro testimony, unquote, theme, the Negro testimony theme, constituted the core of Leo Frank's public relations strategy, Lewis Marshall was not foolish enough to take that unconstitutional absurdity to the high court. Rather, at the core of Marshall's 103-point Supreme Court argument were two main themes. One, the trial was mob-dominated, and two, the insignificant technical point that the entire trial should be invalidated because Frank himself was not in the courtroom when the verdict was read, and that was by his own decision, so the typical Jewiness. Both the defense and the prosecution had agreed to the arrangement whereby Frank would be absent for security reasons, and Prosecutor Dorsey gave his consent only after Frank's attorney specifically agreed that Frank's absence would not be used as a basis for appeal. But being Jews, they reneged. But now, a full 6 months after the verdict, Lewis Marshall reneged on that agreement and actually claimed that Frank's own lawyers had violated their client's right to due process. Well, isn't that tricky? Creating the pretext you need for an appeal. That's got to be bogus. Marshall's brief also went after the jurors. He presented an affidavit from a dentist named W.L. Ricker, who swore that he had heard a, quote, bitter A.H. Hensley, H-E-N-S-L-E-E, say, quote, they are going to break that Jew's neck. When Leon Harrison swore to hearing from juror M. Joe Henning this highly improbable pretrial statement, colon, quote, I believe he did kill the girl, and if any... by any chance I get on the jury that tries him, I'll try my best to have him convicted. I think he is guilty, and I would like to be in a position where I could help break this damn neck. Luther Rosser said of juror Hensley that, quote, he stinks. His ballot, quote, a miserable, dirty farce. But Dorsey claimed to have three affidavits from citizens who had heard Hensley before the trial express his belief in Frank's innocence. In fact, both Hensley and Joe Henning were approved for the jury by Frank and his lawyers. Both jurors emphatically denied Marshall's claims. In fact, it was shown that during the jury's deliberations, it was Hensley who had insisted that the jurors take their time in bringing in a verdict. He was the only juror to vote against the guilty verdict when the jurors were first polled. Ultimately, once he was satisfied that the jury had not rushed to judgment, he joined the others and voted, quote, guilty. Each of the affiants swearing to Hensley's anti-Jewish prejudice appears to be an example of defense-purchased, perjured testimony. But Marshall hung his hat on the issue of Frank's absence from the courtroom, ostensibly to protect him from, quote, a mob. He argued that it represented a violation of the, quote, due process clause of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which not insignificantly was ratified in 1868, to protect the black former slaves from states interfering with their fundamental rights as American citizens. That Marshall used a constitutional provision designed to equalize the legal condition of the black American, even as Frank based his entire public relations strategy on the unacceptability of Negro testimony, is one of the supreme hypocrisies of the Leo Frank case. Marshall had to resort to arguing that flimsy legal premise only because Frank's own courtroom lawyers had obliterated any claim they might make of racial prejudice, they alone having openly and repetitively voiced anti-black racial bigotry. Marshall's ploy might be compared to a knocked-out boxer who later tries to invalidate his defeat because he was unconscious when the referee declared him the loser. The justices were similarly unimpressed. Another of the mainly shameless ironies in Jews who were dealing with chutzpah was that Frank's, you know, like the definition of chutzpah, like murdering your parents and then claiming, demanding mercy from the court on the basis of being an orphan. Definition of chutzpah, how you want to pronounce it. Another of the many shameless ironies was that Frank's Jewish attorney, Henry A. Alexander, who had so strenuously pressed the unacceptability of Negro testimony, cited the Calvin v. Texas case on Frank's behalf. It said, quote, "The accused must be tried and convicted legally, and though he be a Negro, he must be tried in precisely the same manner as if he were a white man, and we cannot strain the law, even in the estimate of a hair, because the appellant is a Negro." Next section, or subsection, mob atmosphere debunked. On Leo Frank's behalf, Lewis Marshall claimed to the highest court that his trial was, quote, "dominated by a mob which was hostile to him and whose conduct intimidated the court and jury and unduly influenced them and neutralized and overpowered their judicial function." So that's probably where the lie begins, at least formally, because then all academics and writers from thenceforth can cite that when they're inventing or they're layering or they're building up this great lie that there was some kind of illegal influence that produced the verdict rather than the sober weighing of the facts brought forward. So the number one Jew in America is willing to tell outright lies to get off a Jewish pedophile rapist murderer. The term, quote, "mob," unquote, was carefully selected by Frank's defense and strategically placed in both his legal filings and public relations onslaught. Its definition as a riotous or disorderly crowd of people or rabble denotes danger, but is yet less declarative than the specific and unprovable charge of anti-Semitism, the charge in which pro-Frank writers have trafficked since the trial's end. The claim of anti-Semitism never made it into any of Leo Frank's voluminous legal filings. Instead, Frank pushed forward individuals who claimed to have witnessed mob-like behavior in and around that Atlanta courtroom. An examination of those claims, however, finds that those supposed mobs were described in very un-mob-like terms as having variously, quote, applauded, all these would be quotes, hurrahed, whispered, shouted, and cheered, not terms used to characterize bloodthirsty, lynch-ready, anti-Semitic rioters. And, curiously, many of those witnesses claiming to have freely intermingled with the pogromic mobs of anti-Semites had such Jewish surnames as Hazan, Lipschitz, Borstin, Rosinke, and Sherman. B.S. Lipschitz says he was, quote, "mingling with the crowd," not the mob, but the crowd, which is defined as merely a large number of persons gathered together, most often at sports or entertainment events. Mingle is defined as, quote, "to circulate among a group of people," for example, guests at a party. None of the voluntarily mingling witnesses reported being threatened, attacked, lynched, or even insulted for their Jewishness, and none were ever known to have faced any form of retaliation for signing their names to such treasonous claims in the heart of Jim Crow, Georgia. It is also difficult to imagine that a Jew, in such an environment of, quote, "mobbish anti-Semitism," unquote, could be moved, as Frank's mother was, to curse the prosecutor in open court, calling him either a Gentile dog or a Christian dog, before getting up and walking out of the courtroom and into the public street. So, you know, they're claiming, oh, anti-Semitism, but his mom, who knows this little bastard is guilty, she absolutely knew he was guilty, but she still curses the courtroom in open court. She curses the judge in open court, or curses the prosecutor, which was it? The prosecutor. She curses Dorsey in open court, calling him a Gentile or Christian dog. That's how confident they were. That's how little they give a shit. How few fucks they give about anyone who's not a Jew. All their behavior shows it. They have absolutely no respect, and that's part of their code, for anyone who isn't a Jew. Everything for the Jews, nothing for everyone else. Her outburst did not set off the kind of retaliatory pogrom one might expect against the Jewish section of the city if the dire assessments of the trial atmosphere were true. The anti-Christian Jewess reappeared in the courtroom the next day, unafraid and unassailed. In fact, it was this Jewish woman's bigoted utterance that introduced Frank's religion into the trial. So the Jews are playing the race and the Jew card. It wasn't the prosecutor. They went by the facts. Flipping on to 282. At one point during the trial, dozens of Jewish character witnesses from all over the United States descended upon the Georgia court, not one of them charging mistreatment by any Georgian Gentile, much less abuse by a mob. Frank's own four-hour-long trial statement, which he gave without allowing the state to cross-examine him, should have induced any mob to virulent demonstration, yet the description of the courtroom by the Atlanta Constitution reporter tells a different story. Quote, "A hush settled over the room throughout his recital, and he was able to talk in an ordinary voice and make himself heard all over the place." With evidence of his guilt mounting, the facts badly failing him, his defense fizzling into fiasco, Leo Frank only then made his Jewishness the centerpiece of his defense, and only then did the, quote, "mob dominance," unquote, claim become a last, desperate hope. The U.S. Supreme Court saw no merit in any of Frank's claims, and on April 9, 1915, upheld the guilty verdict and death sentence by a vote of 7-2, just as the 13 previous courts had done. So I thought there was 13. They said that before. Maybe there are 14 different appeals, all these different courts. They all uphold the conviction and sentence. He was guilty, and there was no way around it, and everybody involved knew it. Everybody involved. Everybody from Marshall and Ox and Lasker to Leo Frank himself to everyone else knew that Leo Max Frank was guilty. Page 283. Governor John M. Slayton saves his own client. Epigraph from same. "I have had many people to comment on me about this depraved, brutal, and criminal Negro whom Dorsey represented as being an ordinary, innocent country darkie." Governor John M. Slayton. On April 9, 1915, nearly 2 years after the murder of Mary Fagan, the United States Supreme Court rejected Leo Frank's last appeal. He was then scheduled to hang by the neck on June 22nd. He had delayed that final decision longer than anyone ever had, but it could not have come sooner for the mass of Georgians who fully believed Frank's execution would mean justice for Mary Fagan. Frank and his attorneys, however, had a formidable ace up their sleeve. Just one day before Frank's scheduled execution, and 5 days before the end of his term, Georgia Governor John Marshall Slayton, S-L-A-T-O-N, stepped between Frank and the hangman's noose and commuted his sentence to life imprisonment. It was a move that infuriated Georgians and ended Slayton's political career. He is cast by Frank supporters as the cool head, the one wise and courageous truth-seeker that saw the obvious innocence of Leo Frank and acted bravely to save the life of a persecuted Jew, but Slayton had an open secret that cast serious suspicion on whether his motives were altruistic at all. John Slayton was a well-connected Georgia politician with a lengthy resume at the top of Georgia politics. He had held several elective offices beginning in 1896, including Speaker of the Georgia House of Representatives, 1905 to 1909, and President of the State Senate, 1909 to 1911, before serving two terms as governor, 1911 to 1915. By the time his fate was placed before the governor, the duly convicted Leo Frank had become an international cause célèbre, thanks to an unprecedented and massive public relations campaign initiated by Albert Lasker and Adolf Ochs. All eyes were fixed on Georgia, and every one of those eyes believed Frank to be the victim of a gross anti-Semitic injustice. Petitions from citizens and letters from celebrities and national and world leaders poured into the governor's office, all demanding that Slayton use his power to free Leo Frank. Lasker and Ochs had no such power in Georgia, however, where most citizens believed they were the victims of an insidious plot hatched by Frank's forces to maneuver the convict to escape justice. Governor Slayton then called for yet another round of hearings, at which both the prosecutor Hugh Dorsey and Frank's advocates argued the case yet again. Slayton reasoned that, quote, new evidence not available at the trial had to be considered, but the clemency hearing apparently was just for show, a mere charade. The decision to commute Leo Frank's sentence was negotiated possibly months before it occurred. For Slayton was concealing a secret that undermined the legitimacy of this unusual hearing. Slayton was a partner in the very law firm that defended Leo Frank, so he should not have done anything. He should have recused himself. Just a few weeks after Frank's indictment in 1913, Slayton's law firm, Slayton and Phillips, merged with a firm Frank had hired, that of Luther Z. Rosser and Morris Brandon. Slayton was just about to assume the office of governor, and Georgia law prohibited a sitting governor from practicing law. So this fortuitous merger at this strangely convenient moment in time suggests that Frank's defense attorneys were planning for the eventuality that the life or death of their client might come to depend on gubernatorial intervention. Rigged. So they show some letterhead of Rosser, Brandon, Slayton, and Phillips in a little graphic on top of 285. By all legal and ethical standards, this brazen conflict of interest required that Slayton recuse himself from the responsibility of passing final judgment on his own client, especially given that his term in office was set to expire on June 26, 1915, and the messy fallout from his actions would then end up in the lap of the incoming governor, Nathaniel Harris. Frank's backers believed that Harris was convinced that Frank had murdered Mary Fagan, and so they pressured Slayton for immediate action before his term ended. All these forces were in play when the Frank team hurriedly moved the case through the state's pardon process and into the hands of teammate Governor John M. Slayton. As previously stated, Slayton is favorably portrayed by Frank partisans as a true crusader for human justice. In reality, Slayton is not known to have lifted any of his 10 congressional, senatorial, or gubernatorial fingers to help the innocent black men and women of Georgia who, all throughout his political career, were being openly tortured, burned at the stake, and hanged from trees by murderous mobs of whites. Under his watch, there were no investigations, no official inquiries, no special prosecutors, no hearings, no trials. Since the beginning of 1915 to the moment of commutation in June, five bullet points, one, two unidentified black men and a woman were lynched in Monticello. Peter Morris was lynched in Arlington. A.B. Culberson was lynched in Evans. Caesar Sheffield was lynched in Valdosta. And Samuel Heavens, H-E-V-E-N-S, was lynched in Toccoa, T-O-C-C-O-A. When, a year earlier, Slayton was begged to stay the unjust executions of three black men, John Paschal, Robert Hart, and Will Hart, Slayton utterly refused. Paschal had confessed to the crime and said that the Hart brothers were not involved. Slayton said that the jury had made its decision on the case, that the men had been represented by the ablest counsel in the county, and that he would not intervene, and thus all three black men were hanged. Only Leo Frank seemed to have excited Slayton's moral conscience. On June 21, 1915, Slayton commuted Frank's death sentence to life in prison, but, tellingly, he would not sign a full pardon. Nonetheless, Georgians made no distinction. Slayton's commutation of Frank's sentence was, to them, a blatant capitulation to the Jewish pressure campaign, the ultimate betrayal of their judicial process. Even those scholars who consider Frank innocent question the sequence of events that saved him. Nancy McLean targets the, quote, immense amounts of money and power marshaled on Frank's behalf, and she admits that, quote, the governor did yield to this power and override the authority of a duly constituted jury. Steve Oney states unequivocally that the Georgia governor was justly criticized, quote, for an undeniable conflict of interests. And Leonard Dinnerstein admits that in one sense the Georgians protesting Frank's commutation, quote, were correct, unquote, colon, and then quote. A poor man would not likely have had friends who could finance successive judicial appeals and promote the national outcry that forced Governor Slayton to spend 10 days reviewing the case. And other powers which have now come to light seem to have influenced Slayton's behavior. As Georgia's chief executive officer, Slayton was believed to have sought loans for the state in the New York offices of Jacob Schiff, the influential banker of the mammoth financial firm Kuhn and Loeb, to whom Lewis Marshall had appealed on Frank's behalf. The investment bank had announced a gigantic $135 million loan fund to finance cotton growers in the South, $100 million coming from non-cotton growing states. That's the Schiff who funded the communist revolutionaries in Russia, of course. Schiff wrote letters seeking assistance for the condemned B'nai B'rith leader and is said to have asked Slayton about his view of the Frank case, even implying that the state's financial future depended on his answer. So a $135 million loan is tied to Slayton's commuting Frank. In fact, correspondence dating from 1915 reveals the beginnings of an unusually warm personal relationship between the two men, in which the banker alludes to financial commitments that he made to Slayton. By January of 1916, Schiff and Slayton were arranging dinner parties between themselves and their wives, and in one handwritten letter to Schiff, Slayton expressed his, quote, deep appreciation for Schiff's assistance in an unstated matter. This was soon followed by other letters in which they discussed the suitable moment for Schiff to replace one law firm with Slayton's firm for work with an important client. There is even correspondence between Schiff and Frank's attorney, Lewis Marshall, in which they discuss Schiff's suggestion that Slayton be appointed to the United States Supreme Court. Exclamation point. The timing of these letters, commencing right after the Frank commutation, and all discussing ways in which the Georgia governor might enhance his financial fortunes, is no coincidence. In June of 1916, Jacob Schiff began pressing the Democratic Party to replace President Woodrow Wilson's vice presidential candidate in his upcoming re-election campaign. About a year earlier, the Atlanta Constitution was trumpeting William Randolph Hearst's plan to back Slayton for the Senate or vice president. The article attributed Slayton's emergence as the favored VP candidate to his action in the Leo Frank case, which, despite having ruined him politically in his home state of Georgia, the paper predicted, quote, will redound for Slayton's betterment and ultimately will result in a boom of countrywide proportions for Slayton as a Democratic candidate for vice presidency. All in all, the political stars, as a direct result of his commuting the death sentence of Leo M. Frank, seem to be aligning for John Marshall Slayton. This collection of correspondence and the choreographed political involvement of major world players like Marshall, Schiff, Hearst, and Wilson can only be interpreted as prima facie evidence of Slayton's reward for Leo Frank's commutation. Can it be doubted that Slayton would have made provisions for himself and his family before committing to an act that nearly 100% of his constituents vehemently opposed? And can it be doubted that such provisions would have to be arranged by those wealthy and fanatical forces who alone would benefit from that controversial action? Despite his bold act of defiance, Slayton's commutation order itself reveals that he may not have wholly believed in Frank's innocence. Slayton wrote that he believed that the Supreme Court, quote, found in the trial no error of law, unquote, and had, quote, correctly, in my judgment, found that there was sufficient evidence to sustain the verdict, unquote. In fact, Slayton could have pardoned the convict outright, but he instead felt that life imprisonment represented, quote, justice, a sentence also reserved for convicted murderers. Slayton also addressed the claim of an anti-Semitic mob surrounding the courtroom, pressing to lynch Frank, a claim that remains one of the pillars of the Leo Frank legend. Quote, no such attack was made and none was contemplated, unquote. He countered that Jews were highly respected and appreciated in Georgia because they had been prominent and even, quote, conspicuous contributors to the history and development of the slavery-dependent Jim Crow state. As stated, Slayton justified his decision to commute not on any flaw in the court proceeding, but on the basis of new evidence, much of which was produced by the disgraced detective William J. Burns. Referring to the counterfeit so-called Carter letters, Slayton wrote in language almost directly lifted from the Frank team playbook, quote, the evidence shows that Conley was as depraved and lecherous a Negro as ever lived in Georgia, unquote. Slayton's order is further tainted by his acceptance of Frank's racial paradigm, twice stating that the murder notes were written in, quote, a Negro's handwriting, and referring to Frank's helper as the Negro Conley. Had Slayton used the term the Jew Frank, the bigotry would have been self-evident. Slayton's order may have momentarily saved Leo Frank, but the governor and his family were run out of Georgia, he becoming the first governor in American history to call the National Guard for his protection. It's true, they almost lynched him. And he certainly deserved it. It would be years later that he slinked back into town and practiced at the law firm rebranded as Rosser, Slayton, Phillips, and Hopkins. In the end, Slayton never realized the benefit he had expected and was promised. His Supreme Court appointment hopes were dashed almost as quickly as they emerged. Jacob Schiff apparently asked Lewis Marshall to pursue that line, but Marshall was quick to respond to Schiff in a private letter, clearly unwilling to advocate for a man for whom he had little professional respect. Quote, I must confess that I am unable as a lawyer to say that he is the man whom I would select as a member of that exalted court. Unquote. Slayton was left to traffic in the same racism that upheld his unremarkable political career. In a telegram sent from his exile in San Francisco, shortly after the lynching of his client, Leo Frank, he wrote, quote, my action, a commutation of Frank, protected every white farmhand and every white mechanic in Georgia from the conflicting prejudice of a drunken criminal Negro. Unquote. Slayton continued to follow the case, bitterly hoping for some proof that his treasonous action was justified. He is found writing to Adolph Ox in 1919, prodding him to report on the recent arrest of a Jim Conley for an alleged burglary. Of course, he wrote, quote, any man willing to commit burglary would commit murder. I have had many people to comment to me about this depraved, brutal, and criminal Negro whom Dorsey represented as being an ordinary, innocent country darky. 291. And they didn't even go into the interesting part where they actually came very close to lynching him, and he fled up to New York to give big speeches about, and was feted by the Jews up there who were funding Frank's defense or the campaign to get him a new trial or get him loosed or rehabilitate his reputation in any case. 291, treating me white, Frank's semi-idyllic life in custody. Two epigraphs. He was then dressed in stripes and given the prison number 965. He will be put to work as a common field hand, reported in the Atlanta Georgian, June 21, 1915. Under the laws of Georgia, all able-bodied male convicts are sentenced and worked on the chain gangs of the different counties. Governor Nathaniel E. Harris, who succeeded Slayton. Finally, my life here must be kept quiet. Leo M. Frank in prison. Again, this subsection, Frank's semi-idyllic life in custody. A prison cell in the American South is no place anyone wants to be, and the prison system in Jim Crow, Georgia, had a particularly nasty reputation for violence and cruelty. Medieval dungeon conditions, dank and filthy, overcrowded cells, vicious, sadistic jailers, ball-and-chain convicts in striped overalls and hangman's ropes at the ready, were the actual conditions faced by Georgia's overwhelmingly black inmates. The state operated its chain gangs in a manner indistinguishable from actual slavery, with captives housed and transferred from worksite to worksite in the kind of rolling metal lattice cage used for zoo animals. Georgia had pioneered the use of torture methods such as waterboarding, described in an 1870 official report thus, quote, pouring a stream of water into the mouth of a convict stretched on his back, much of it got into the lungs, and at best it produced a fit of choking, just like we do at Guantanamo. The ultimate purpose of this treatment was to keep blacks terrorized, submissive, and serviceable to the dictates of white supremacy. Their incarceration had nothing to do with their supposed criminality, but instead was a direct reflection of the state's labor needs. Douglas Blackman, author of Slavery by Another Name, is very clear on that point. Quote, and the truth was that in most places in the South, there was almost no criminal activity, almost no arrests, except at a time when one of these large industrial interests or commercial interests needed labor. And when that was the case, local sheriffs would begin these aggressive roundups. You know, Mencken actually used to write about some of that. Like, whenever the city hall or whatever needed repainting, the cops would be sent out to bust, and not even blacks, but like white painters and electricians, et cetera, haul them in on, you know, various charges so that they would be forced to do the work the city needed. So even up in Maryland, that was the case. Captured black men in leg manacles worked on public road building projects as state-owned slaves under the whip of an overseer. When Floyd County's black, quote, convicts refused to work under these desperate conditions, they were whipped until they relented. It was reported in the newspaper not as an outrageous violation of human rights, but as proof to the readers that the authorities were effectively doing their job. If prejudice and bigotry are anywhere in the South, they are in its prison systems, and one would expect that its fiendish administrators would be overjoyed to get their hands on a convicted child murderer and suspected molester of white adolescent girls. New York lawyer Arthur Garfield Hayes fancifully imagined the harrowing scene. Quote, Leo Frank was subject to constant and daily torture from the other prisoners who, whatever their crimes, detested this northern Jew, degenerate, and child murderer. It is with that horrifying backdrop that we now examine the incarceration of Leo Frank in the state of Georgia. Upon his indictment, and while on trial, the B'nai B'rith leader was held at the Fulton County Tower Jail in Atlanta, and the newspaper accounts began to describe conditions that have never been before or since been applied to any form of incarceration in America. Frank, quote, redecorated his cell, quote, seeing to it that the floors were polished, the walls scrubbed, and two chairs and a table installed, unquote. Officials allowed him to accept his visitors, quote, in the jailer's dining room on the first floor, where his friends and family brought him his, quote, papers and delicacies, unquote. Not unapprovingly, the Atlanta Constitution ran the headline, cell of Leo M. Frank now like living room, quote, the cell of Leo M. Frank in the tower is fast assuming the appearance of a living room. Yesterday, a new bed and a number of furnishings arrived. All the day, prison attachés worked renovating the interior, oiling the floor and cleaning the windows. Heretofore, they, Mrs. Frank and her husband, have accepted the use of the jailer's dining room on the first floor. A Constitution writer reported that Frank, quote, takes regular daily exercise, spends much of his time walking, and, at specified times, is granted the privileges of the runway alongside his cell, where he finds freer walking. What spare time he finds, when not talking to his friends, the prisoner devotes to his mail and to the newspapers, by which he keeps well posted on all important topics of the day. Frank's father-in-law brought him breakfast every day, which usually consisted of cantaloupe, rolls, and coffee. And his wife brought hors d'oeuvres and fresh Georgia peaches before he took his daily meetings with his business partners. Dinner arrived at 1:30 p.m., and his wife joined him for supper at 4. He welcomed his friends in his, quote, parlor most evenings, and on most days studied the issues surrounding his case. The Atlanta Constitution further explained, quote, Frank's latest method of amusing himself in his prison cell is to solicit the autograph of every visitor. He is insistent on this point before he will see anyone, it is stated, and it is estimated that he has already accumulated hundreds upon hundreds of signatures. He is keeping a diary of each day's happenings and faithfully sets down every detail of each hour. So pretty darn cushy. He settled into what seemed like a pleasant routine, that's a direct quote, and even carried on a card game by mail with a bridge writer for the New York Times. His cell was filled with letters from vacationing friends traveling in exotic locations. He exercised with a set of dumbbells and read the morning paper in his robe. A reporter wrote, quote, Leo Frank's cell was a mecca for visitors yesterday. Friends came to the jail in crowds, appearing as early as daybreak and as late as 10 o'clock at night. He occupies an entire cell block in Ward 3. They give him a goddamn suite. This pedophile rapist murderer. He's marrying, he's molesting a little kid and then strangling her, for Christ's sakes, and jabbing something into her, which is rape, too. Frank was not even handcuffed, as he was brought to and from court for his murder trial. Well, he was a scrawny little pup, so, you know. This was so unusual that Sheriff C. Wheeler Mangum had to issue a public explanation of the practice. Jewish newspaper legend Abraham Kahan, C-A-H-A-N, visited Frank in jail, probably expecting Frank to have been thumbscrewed in dungeon-like squalor. Quote, the neighboring cells, six, were empty. As I immediately realized, the sheriff had intentionally not placed other prisoners there in order for Frank to feel more comfortable and to be able to have friends visit, because the sheriff, a man named Wheeler Mangum, was convinced that Frank was innocent, and he did everything so that Frank's life in captivity would be easier. He had also permitted him to bring his own bed and bedding from home. One of the cells was larger than the others, and the Franks and their guests used it as a parlor, sitting or standing and speaking through the bars. Only Mrs. Frank was permitted by the sheriff to go inside his cell. The rest of the visitors used to stand outside the cell in the open, quote-unquote, parlor. Mrs. Frank used to spend entire days there in his cell. I jokingly remarked about the seven-room apartment that Frank rented here, and he laughed heartily. So always the Jews get special privileged treatment while they're going on about white privilege. And how's the nigger Conley being treated, who merely told the truth? He's not being treated like that. Thomas E. Watson revealed that Frank even, quote, spoke of his separate room and the Negro convict who had been detailed to wait on him. It appears Leo Frank, a convicted murderer, actually had a black servant. Immediately after his sentence was commuted by Governor Slayton on June 21, 1915, Frank was relocated to the state's high-security Milledgeville facility, where he, as Convict 965, enjoyed what could only be called spa-like comfort in Milledgeville. Modern showers and other conveniences that were not even in the homes of most law-abiding Georgians were provided to white inmates at Milledgeville. The surroundings, says Oney, were actually lovely, terraced into the rolling landscape while tall pines lined the road. Macon, Georgia, Telegraph, quote, beyond a doubt, some of the people in that prison are in better living surroundings than they were before they went there. Frank had 5 hours of unspecified, quote, daily chores, and the rest of the day free, one day writing 16 letters, 18 the next. His letters during the first few weeks at the prison farm, wrote Leonard Dinnerstein, quote, resemble those of a child vacationing at a summer camp. In one, Frank writes, quote, we get the finest Alberta peaches and watermelons here, grown on the farm. The apples are stewed for me. I also sleep well. The gifts poured in to Frank's gated countryside abode, an Ingersoll watch, a shaving mirror, a box of cigars, chocolate cake, books aplenty, a footlocker that overflowed with tins of crackers and sardines, packs of cigarettes and gum. According to Frank, a Mr. Alford, quote, brought me toilet and shaving articles, including bath and face towels. He received a shipment of phonograph records, which he played on the warden's own Victrola machine. He was much exasperated one day, complaining, quote, "You know I have so much mail and I like to keep things clear and orderly." Frank sat at, quote, "a big roller-top desk where he spent his days preparing his correspondence. He accepted both cash and checks at Milledgeville and received daily deliveries of both the Atlanta Journal and the New York Times. He was even able to offer postal services to his wife back in Atlanta. Quote, "Let me know if you need some stamps and I can send you some so you can write to me." And there's this one he penned about his universal health care plan. Quote, "Dear Lucille, I am having plenty of fresh air, sunshine, and exercise. I am doing no work and will do none until I am physically fit. The physician sees me every day. I forgot to tell you to include 2 or 3 dozen handkerchiefs in the package you express me. C.O. Warden J.E. Smith. Also, a couple pair of my lightweight pajamas, as I had 5 visitors today, all prominent men from Milledgeville, and all very friendly to me. One of these men sent me a sack of oranges and lemons. After a day or two, I will speak to Warden Smith about you and my parents paying me a visit. I am fondly your Honey." Isn't that sweet? Frank appears to never have had to suffer prison food. Now, Mr. Wall, quote, "so kindly brings my dinner." At one lunch, his menu consisted of muffins, asparagus, and kippered herring. The last two were canned goods and tasted very fine. Direct quote. He wrote one day that after light duties, he had settled into a breakfast of biscuits, eggs, and buttermilk. Frank couldn't have been happier, especially after, quote, "the houseman gave me a new cotton mattress, which is 100% better than the one of grass which I had." Whatever Milledgeville's maitre d' couldn't provide, Frank simply requested of his wife, quote, "I will need a soap container of enameled ware or celluloid to be sent with the other things, and 5 sets underwear and 6 pair socks, but not silk," he cautioned. Dinnerstein described Frank's prison experience as, quote, "a semi-idyllic life." To his attorney Luther Rosser, he wrote, quote, "The warden and his staff are very kind and solicitous. I have several hours a day for reading, writing, or any reasonable form of exercise and diversion. The sunshine and atmosphere here are great. I have plenty of opportunity to view plant life, and my field observation in the criminopsychological field is practically limitless." The warden is, quote, "a fine fellow," he wrote to his wife. "I know you will like him." To others, he gushed, "The warden and his staff here are very kind to me. I know I shall get along nicely with them." To his wife, he wrote what no black man could ever write from a Georgia penitentiary. Quote, "This morning I had a talk with Judge Davidson of the commission and the warden. They both are my friends and will do all in their power for my best interests. The officials are very kind and thoughtful. I think the prison commission will order, on request, that every courtesy be shown you and the family. Warden Smith would do this anyway, as he is every inch a true blue southern gentleman." As for the warden, he indignantly and deceptively warded off public suspicions of Frank favoritism. Quote, "I swear that this is the one place where money doesn't count, and I'll prove it to the world." Unquote. Frank is not known to have spent a single moment in a striped prison outfit or in hard labor of any kind. And finally, the greatest compliment of all. Frank wrote a letter to his lawyer explaining with evident satisfaction that the, quote, "warden and his staff have treated me white." Imagine how NOI must be boiling about all this because they're, you know, blacks. "Goddamn nigger can't catch a break. This motherfucker can be getting all freshy bowl of peaches and shit." Nowhere in the annals of the history of blacks in the American penal system, or for that matter in the general American population, is there a comparable experience enjoyed by the man who had actually been convicted of child murder, Leo Frank. And while Frank was treated white, blacks were treated black, black, black. In the very same Milledgeville prison that accorded Leo Frank such lavish accommodations, 140 blacks, including 21 boys, were crowded into 150-by-100-foot room of a barn with no toilet facilities and no sewers. According to a report, The feces and urine are deposited in buckets kept in the overcrowded sleeping quarters. The drinking water was contaminated by excrement and other matter from the tuberculosis hospital. Prisoners had to share 110 bunks, and a sizable group of inmates suffered from typhoid fever. It took 30 years after Frank's prison stay for a court to condemn Georgia's chain gang system as, quote, cruel and unusual punishment. And less than a decade after Frank's time in the pen, the local drugstore in Milledgeville greeted its customers with a macabre countertop display, a large alcohol-filled bottle in which was preserved the fingers and ears of two blacks recently lynched. An inscription beside the bottle read, quote, "What's left of the niggers that shot a white man." This astounding disparity in the treatment and living conditions of Jews and blacks is ignored by scholars of the Leo Frank case. Frank himself understood that his treatment to be so extraordinary, so much so that he actually warned his wife about revealing too much about it. Quote, "You know that a good deal of my life here for the present has to be guided in such a way as to allay public animosity and criticism. You will, I know, realize that the contents of my letters and my life here must be kept quiet. Instead of fanning this matter now, we want to let it lie dormant for the present so that the Georgian people can get back to normal. Don't let on about the good treatment I'm receiving. Let it die down." Frank's sanctuary was violently disrupted on the night of July 17, 1915, when a fellow white inmate named William Crean, C-R-E-E-N, snatched Frank from his slumber and stabbed him in the neck. Crean was rumored to have told Governor Nathaniel E. Harris that he cut Frank's throat because, quote, Frank had tried to sodomize him. Frank's medical treatment was immediate and thorough, and while being nursed back to health, he was attended to by skilled physicians. An office was made over just for the medical treatment and care of Leo Frank. The incident and his recovery were reported in great detail by the Atlanta newspapers. Page 300 now. Within hours, the State Prison Board was proposing resolutions to investigate the negligent use of butcher knives at the prison, and a subcommittee was formed to investigate the assault. The Atlanta Journal published a photograph of the exterior of the prison building where the assault occurred, and another of the dormitory area itself where Frank had been confined. Governor Harris and other officials actually visited the prison themselves just to see about the condition of Leo Frank. Crean was interviewed by the governor, who sought the reason for his actions. According to the American Israelite, that is the number one Jew paper in America, on his visit to see Leo Frank, Governor Harris was, quote, shocked by conditions at the prison and said he intended to pardon a large number of the convicts confined there. The governor was so deeply affected by the sights he witnessed, this is a quote, that tears rolled down his cheeks as he talked about them. How frightening must have been the conditions for blacks such that the leader of the state with the most lynchings could be brought to tears? The committee soon reported, quote, "We find that it is nothing short of savagery to work these convicts these long hot days, compelling them to sleep at night in a veritable oven, ill-smelling and beyond description." They concluded that all other inmates at the prison were being denied, quote, humanitarian treatment. Next segment and last one for this particular session. Leo Frank, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Epigraph, "I am as innocent today as I was 1 year ago." Leo Frank, that's a nice little double meaning there, because he knows he's guilty. By the generally accepted definition of lynching, quote, "any assemblage of three or more persons which shall exercise or attempt to exercise by physical violence and without authority of law, any power of correction or punishment." Frank's murder on August 17, 1915, at the hands of his kidnappers, certainly qualified. But the lynching of Leo Frank was quite dissimilar from all other known lynchings in the South. The white men who planned and carried out the act against one of their own race, sick, he was a Jew, were not provoked by the fervor of a single moment. They were not the whiskey-soaked, thrill-seeking white trash or innocent bystanders swept up by mob passions. The American Israelite, quote, "The word mob does not seem descriptive, for these men did not display the ordinary characteristics of a mob. There was no outburst of rage, no disorder. The whole thing was done with order, method, and precision, and with a military attention to details. Lynching mobs are usually composed of riffraff, but this one consisted of leading citizens in the community, then prominent in business and social circles, and even in the church. Scholars who have analyzed the events surrounding the lynching of Leo Frank, the ninth lynching in Georgia that year, have settled on some basic elements of the incident. On August 17th, after several weeks of military planning, 25 of Georgia's most prominent white leaders in 8 automobiles caravanned to Milledgeville State Prison, where Frank was being held, cut the telephone lines, overpowered the guards, and snatched Frank from his prison cell. In solemn procession, they drove back across the state to Mary Fagan's hometown. The men told Frank that they were there to carry out the verdict as it had been rendered and reaffirmed again and again by 13 judicial bodies. Resigned to his fate, Frank asked that his wedding ring be returned to his wife, a request that the lynchers honored. Leo Frank was then hanged from an oak tree in a section of Marietta known as Fry's Gin. A handkerchief was placed respectfully over the face of the victim, such that the body cannot even be positively identified in the photographs, something that was never done when the victim was black. The body of Leo Frank was removed from Georgia and interred in his family's plot at Mount Carmel Cemetery in New York, where it is today marked by a modest headstone. But his death at the hands of vigilantes on August 17, 1915, did not end the intrigue and mystery surrounding the Frank case. And there's a picture of his lynching, broken neck, head pointing up. He's a very, very slight man. I don't know what he weighed, maybe 120 or something. He was very small, scrawny little fellow. And then there's a picture of Fry's Gin, a big old tree, the approximate lynching site of Leo Frank. Highway Route 401 off Roswell Road, Fry's Gin Road, kind of in the triangle there. Then a picture of his grave marker, Leo Max Frank, beloved husband, April 17th, 1884 to August 17th, 1915. So he committed this murder when he was 29, and he was hanged when he was, 31, basically. And that will do it for this section. So we made it up through 304 pages. Of the Nation of Islam's the Leo Frank case, the lynching of a guilty man. So he got special treatment at every step of the way. He had the most expensive trial. He had the best lawyers. They lied. They played the race card. They acted utterly dishonest and obnoxious. And then after he was duly convicted, they did everything they could to build a national campaign to get his sentence commuted, and after that even failed because all the evidence was against him, as 13, 14 courts found. They resorted to bribing the governor to get his sentence commuted, if not to set him free, at least to life rather than hanging as he deserved, and they got that. But ultimately, the good men of Georgia decided to see that justice was done, and they took him out of the jail and hanged him, and he utterly and completely deserved it. And no one can say otherwise, though the Jews have been lying about it and trying to rehabilitate him for 100 years. Thanks for being with me today. I will be back with you again real soon.